Hi, I'm Karen Hartglass, and this is It's All About Food. I'm really looking forward to today's show, as I look forward to every show. I'm always inviting some people that I respect very much, who are great activists and people doing wonderful things in the world to make it a better place. Today we'll be talking with Patrice Jones in a few minutes. But before we do that, I just wanted to talk a little bit about something I read. One of my favorite doctors, Dr. John McDougall. He has a website at drmcdougall.com, drmcdougall.com. And he frequently brings up the fact that there's a lot of information in the news that's really misleading. And you get these sound bites or pieces from journal articles that have come out that make some claims that really are misconstrued and not true. So most recent was a worldwide headline from July 2nd about vegetarian diet weakens bones. And it's certainly not true. And it was some information from something called a meta-analysis, where a variety of different studies were combined and then analyzed. And when you do something like this, you have the opportunity to really play with the information to get the results that you want. But in comparison, there have been many other studies, and one that he brought out in particular was something published in the April 2009 Journal of Osteoporosis International, where 105 postmenopausal Buddhist nuns were compared to 105 omnivorous women, and these women were, the nuns were vegans. And the conclusion was that vegetarian veganism, in fact, which is when you're not consuming any animal products, does not have an adverse effect on bone mineral density and does not alter body composition. We've talked a number of times about healthy bones, and what people don't realize is a diet that's rich in animal foods, meat and dairy, tends to actually leach calcium from the blood because these are foods that leave a very acidic environment, and the body tries to neutralize that acidity by drawing calcium from the bones. In addition, foods like sodas with phosphoric acid, like colas or coffee, and salty foods tend to leach calcium from the body. So you have to know that a healthy vegetarian diet or a healthy vegan diet is not going to be damaging on the bones. And when you read these things in the news, you have to look a lot deeper. So my guest today is Patrice Jones, and she's originally from Baltimore and had a sanctuary for birds in Maryland, and then has done quite a bit of work since the 70s and has been a phenomenal ecofeminist educator and activist. And I believe she's standing by. Are you there, Patrice?
I am.
Oh, hi.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you. I'm really looking forward to hearing all about you.
Uh-oh.
Okay, so let's go back. I understand your activism goes back to the 70s.
Indeed.
So when did you first become a vegetarian? Let's start with that.
I quit eating meat when I was 15.
Me too, 15.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the same year that I came out as a lesbian.
Right. Well, they're connected, I think.
A gay rights rally. Yep. And it took me, another 15 years to understand how those two choices may be linked,
mm-hmm.
or were linked, but I did make them at the same time. Now, I have to say, like many vegetarians, whose vegetarianism is rooted in an incomplete analysis. I wasn't always a reliable vegetarian, and I wasn't vegan until much later in my life, when I really came to understand that this wasn't just a personal choice.
Right.
But also an ethical. Well, it was an ethical choice to begin with, personally, for me, but I didn't really get how that choice linked up with all of my other ethical commitments, such as commitments against racism, sexism, poverty, for the environment, etc. Once I really got that link, then there was no more question.
Well, it just shows you what an incredible kind of cover, or I don't know what to call it, brainwashing or socializing, we've all been through that cloaks the obvious.
Mm.
And once you see it, it's all obvious.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really difficult for so many people. Okay,
yeah,
so
it's always interesting for me to think back on the years when I was a social change activist insisting vigorously that we all understand the connections among racism and sexism and homophobia, and then later how that all linked up with environment. And all along, I'm vegetarian because I don't want to eat animals, and I'm vaguely supportive of animal rights,
mm-hmm.
but I don't make that connection. I think mm-hmm. of it as something separate. And for me, at least, interestingly, what actually broke me through was my own graduate research into the history of racism, the psychological history of racism. And I was using a method that's called grounded theory, which is when you go investigating without a pre-existing hypothesis, understanding that you don't know what you're going to find out, and that what you might find out might have nothing to do with what you would have hypothesized, might even be something you didn't want to know or didn't want to think about. And what happened to me over the course of years of research that drove me further and further back into time, I found myself looking at the conjunction of patriarchy, which is male rule, and pastoralism, which is animal herding, and saying, whoa, one, these two things are completely tangled up together.
Right.
And I absolutely cannot separate out sexism and speciesism.
Right.
And two, those two things form the ground within which, centuries later, racism grew.
Right.
And at around that same time, my former partner, Miriam Jones, and I had gotten together, and she was starting to do a little bit of animal activism and giving little donations to animal rights organizations so we would be getting all of the mailings. And,
yeah, once you're on one list, you're on all of them.
And finding out more and more things, and that's when I became vegan, because that's then when I found out that sort of in conjunction with me starting to think more clearly about the oppression of, and exploitation of animals, I'm also confronted with the reality of what happens to dairy cows and hens and egg factories, who are, you know, not only just horribly, wretchedly exploited and then still killed for meat,
mm-hmm.
But also specifically exploited in a specifically sexual way. And
right.
So then, you know, this is not just wrong, but also wrong in a way that's absolutely infused with sexism. And so, you know, that was it in terms of me being vegan. And very shortly thereafter, we moved to a rural region, not really understanding, because census data tells you that it's an agricultural region, but not what kind of agriculture, so we didn't actually know. We were moving into an epicenter of poultry production, and in fact moving into the region where factory farming of chickens had been invented.
Oh, goodness.
And within 2-3 weeks, maybe a month of moving, we found a chicken by the side of the road.
Mm-hmm.
Took the chicken in, and that was the beginning of the Eastern Shore Sanctuary.
Wow.
Which is still around. We founded it in 2000, and we just a couple of weeks ago relocated the main site of the sanctuary up to Springfield, Vermont, though we still have we still are active in rural Maryland and still have a process in place for saving the birds down there. And like most sanctuaries, we provide sanctuary for the animals, but from the start, our sanctuary has always understood that what we're doing is not just taking care of these particular animals, not just advocating for animal rights, but doing that within an awareness of how that links up with the other social problems that we're concerned.
I want to get back to this whole concept of connecting the dots with racism, homophobia, sexism, speciesism, but just for a moment, do we hear some of your friends in the background?
Yes, you are hearing them in the background, and it's raining right now, or I'd be talking to you from the deck, and you'd be hearing them even more, but you are hearing... There we go, right on cue. Some crowing.
So I think what so many people don't realize is how intelligent and how loving and intuitive and sensitive chickens and other birds can be.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I know you've got many, many stories.
I do. It I was somebody who I really thought birds were amazing and charming and beautiful, and I always put out bird seed and bird feeders and loved to watch the birds. But I really assumed that mammals and avians were just such dissimilar kinds of creatures that it wouldn't really be possible to have a relationship with a bird or even begin to get where they're coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And I still know that there are many, many, many things about their way of being in the world, their way of communicating with each other, their way of doing what they do, seeing what they see, that I'll never get because it's just too different. But in fact, we're all related. And you can see this when you look at the feet of chickens. If you look at the bottom of their feet, they look so much like the palms of our hands. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And that very first chicken that we took in, I kind of had my grandmother's eyes. So I right away started to rethink this whole idea of just how different we were. And have come more to an appreciation that we are in some ways completely different, and in other ways very much the same. And it's absolutely true that chickens and other birds have much more intelligence than most people give them credit for. There's a great book, by the way, called Bird Brains, which talks some about bird intelligence. And,
did you hear a story recently? I may not get it right, but I think it was, in a German zoo, there were some penguins, I think they were, and this couple gave birth to a penguin and rejected the baby, and then they put it in with these two gay penguins who brought it up.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love that story.
Yeah.
From so many angles.
Well, yes, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, obviously... Or not, I guess not obviously to many people, but certainly just within their own species, you know, birds have their social animals just as we are social animals. What's most important to them, just like us, are relationships with each other. Just like us, they're sometimes able to have relationships with members of other species.
Mm-hmm.
And so some chickens do want to hang out with people and form relationships with people. Some chickens make friends with ducks, with cats. But certainly, as with us, you know, what really matters to them are their relationships with each other, and that's just one of the many, many tragedies associated with the ways that we use and abuse animals, or the degree to which we interrupt, interfere with, destroy their family relationships and
their families and their communities.
Mm-hmm. Pardon?
Their families and their communities.
Exactly. Their families, their communities, their friendships. You know, even the domesticated animals, so-called domesticated animals who are treated, who tend to be treated more kindly, such as cats and dogs, even they, you know, routinely separated from their siblings, routinely taken away from their parents by people who claim to love them.
Right. That's something I don't understand. This disconnect that so many people have, and that we've had, but at some point we had this epiphany. People that can have pets and really love them, and they're family members, and then they have dinner and eat some animals, and they never get it. And I've spoken to many of them. They can be really defensive, and so I think that subconsciously, at least, they do get it. But what do we do to connect those dots? How do we do that? Have you seen anything that works?
So I'm supposed to come up with the answer?
Well, no, I know there's no one answer, and I just have,
no,
other
I,
than
I,
education and being the
well,
best
clearly
that
we
can.
Clearly we haven't figured out. Did you just hear that strange noise?
Yes.
I don't know what
sounded like
that
a
was.
Cow. Or somebody had something to say. Or somebody had something to say.
We clearly haven't figured out what we need to do. But I think, and I talk a good bit in my book Aftershock about what we all need to do to connect up all sorts of dots. I think the root of the problem is dissociation, is splitting off of things inside ourselves, making artificial divisions outside of ourselves, dividing, cutting things off, not connecting, for various reasons. Splitting off thoughts and feelings, splitting off unwanted feelings, splitting off unwanted thoughts, splitting up families, splitting up the land and selling it, etc. With a fundamental understanding that those kinds of traumatic disruptions in continuity are at the root of virtually every problem,
exactly.
Then we can see that any kind of connecting of the dots we can do is going in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether that's helping people to see how speciesism is connected to problems that do concern them, or whether that's helping people to heal some of the traumatic splits within themselves, so that they can have fuller access to their feelings, including all of those split-off feelings that they have about animals, because they're there.
Mm-hmm.
They might not cry at the dinner table now, but probably the first time they figured out that hamburger was cow, they did cry
right.
at the dinner table. And somebody, thinking they were doing them a favor, taught them not to cry, taught them not to care, taught them to split off that natural sympathy for animals. And that was done in conjunction with the process of so-called socialization, in which we teach children to disown the wild sides of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And
Have you seen the book Why We Don't Eat Animals?
Is that the children's book?
Yeah.
I've not read it myself, but I know a child who likes it very much.
Okay, because I've been asking around about it, because it's supposed to be geared for 6 to 10, that age group. And it certainly looks like that sort of child book.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm just wondering what the responses and reactions are. I'm really glad the book is out there, but I don't know that I want to show it to a six-year-old because it's not a story that I want to tell. I don't know. I have mixed feelings about it. You know, I have a niece and nephew. They're 2 and 4, and they're vegan.
Mm-hmm.
And I just prefer to share the joyful side of eating vegetables rather than the sad side. But, you know, at some point they're going to have to know the reality.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's
well, I think, you know, I think we're sort of verging into... there are a lot of questions involved in terms of how to raise children to not lose touch with their feelings in a culture where, you know, all their peers have been taught to to suppress their feelings. So, and I don't think that we've fully done the job, although there are a lot of people working in the field of humane education who've done a lot of really good thinking.
Right.
So we, you know, we need to be listening to them. I think we still have a lot of ways to go in terms of thinking through how to help kids negotiate this. You know, certainly you don't want to make children who are going to be forced to eat meat by their parents or in their school system. You don't want to make them feeling hot. Guilty.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you don't want to collude in this process of suppressing their natural sympathy for animals. It's tricky. But certainly moving back up to the level of what we can do for adults, helping people to access those split-off feelings, even though the process of doing so can be really painful because then it forces you to realize what you've been doing.
Just like anything, I think the change can be difficult.
It leaves you stronger.
It's painful,
it leaves
you
happier,
when you get to the other side, it's relief, it's peace, it's beauty, it's joy.
Yeah. But there's some rough going through it.
Yeah.
You know, I know that and I try to always keep touch with it. It would, you know, it would be very easy. That's why I made sure I said to you when you said, well, when did you quit eating meat? And I said, oh, when I was 15. Try to make sure when I have the chance to say more, to say, you know, I wasn't always a reliable vegetarian. I did slip sometimes. I wasn't vegan yet.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to lose touch with that truth. Because then it would be easy to then lose touch with, you know, how folks feel who are in that position.
Right.
You know, I know for me, you know, the process of going vegan was, you know, filled with a great deal of anguish concerning the degree to which I had colluded with the exploitation of cows. You know, and the degree to which, if I really thought about it, you know what, I always say, oh, I didn't know, but I knew.
Mm-hmm.
At some level, I knew.
Yeah. I like to say, you know, it's easy for me now. I've been doing this for so long, and I could never imagine. I don't see the other things. I don't see meat as dairy and dairy as food. I just don't see it that way. But looking back, it did take quite a while of reprogramming where I would look at the food and say, this is, and I would label it with things, especially dairy. I would label it with, this is pain and suffering, this is cancer, this is, you know, all kinds of bad things, rather than this is yummy, delicious, satisfying. But it takes a while, and you're right, it's important to connect with the challenge that people go through in the change.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I think with dairy, you know, it's really important to remember this is milk, and what milk is, you know, it's what a mammal produces in her body to feed her babies, you know, and so You know, what we've got here, it's not just generic pain and suffering. You know, what we have here is a mother robbed of her milk. What we have here is a mother robbed of her child.
Mm-hmm.
What we also have here is us, humans, in a country where the vast majority of women don't breastfeed.
Right.
You know, and their children thus are, you know, they've outsourced that to cows. And, you know, their children are then robbed of their mother's milk. And both mother and child are robbed of the experience, the bonding, the essential process of being together.
You know, this just popped in my head. I don't know why I'm remembering it, but I think it was from Sesame Street that I watched when I was about 9 or 10 years old with my younger brother. And there was a brief little series on cows in the farm, and the narrator said, "The cow makes much too much milk for her young calf to drink." I'll never forget it. Those are the exact words. And going into the fact that, you know, oh, there's this flowing abundance of milk, and we need to drink it.
Right.
And I'm sure that it wasn't intentional.
You think not?
I don't know. Maybe, but I don't know that the person creating that show really realized what they were doing. I don't know that all of it's intentional. I think everybody's in this big brainwash mush.
Right.
I mean, maybe they were getting a big donation from some
dairy
organization. I don't know, but I'll never forget those words.
Mm-hmm.
Imprinted on my young mind.
No mention of the fact that, you know, the vast majority of dairy cows have their children taken right away. There's no chance to offer any of her milk to any of her children.
Mm-hmm.
And no mention of the fact that they produce so much milk because of the growth hormones that they're fed.
Yes.
And that they have painful mastitis and other infections.
I don't even know if people realize this, but when they look at most dairy cows in America, the udders are so grossly enlarged.
Mm-hmm.
And it became really apparent to me when I would go to Costa Rica, which I make frequent trips there now, and the cows there that kind of roam naturally, their udders are tiny.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just so physically different. Because
mm-hmm.
we've distorted these poor animals to create so much milk.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you wrote a book, Aftershock. Mm-hmm. What was the motivation to do that? And tell me a little bit about it.
Well, a few years ago, I wrote and I was at a conference, sitting around after the conference, talking with other activists, and we happened to mention an activist who we'd seen at the conference and we were really happy to see because she seemed to have dropped off the map for a while, and you know, it turned out that what had happened was she'd been very depressed.
Mm.
And that got us talking about the incidence of depression among social justice activists of all sorts. And as it happened, one of the people in that conversation was the editor of Satya magazine, which was published in New York City but is now defunct.
Yes.
And I was talking some about some of the things we could do about that, used drawing upon my graduate training in clinical psychology. And a couple days later, she asked me would I like to write an article about some of the things that I said for the magazine, and I did. And so many people said that it was so helpful to them that Martin Rowe of Lantern Books actually came up to me the next time I was at a conference and asked me if I would please expand that article into a book,
mm-hmm.
Not just for animal liberation activists, but for all people working in social justice activism, nonprofit organizations, etc. The whole question of how do we handle the everyday trauma, the stress, the grief, the
That's right.
The stress disorder, the depression that comes along with doing, with trying to heal such a violent world as we live in. And so I wrote the book.
So do you have a few nuggets, words, pearls of wisdom? What we should do? Us, handful
well,
of
Well, first of all, make connections. Make connections in every way you can. Make connections with other people. Remember, trauma is some sort of cutting up, some sort of breaking up, some sort of tearing into. And we know that one of the ways that people can heal from any sort of trauma, and also one of the ways to just manage stress and depression, to make connections. Make connections with other people. Make connections with make connections. Try and yourself. I'm hearing buzzing now.
Yeah, I am too, and I'm wondering if it's my phone.
Ah, no, we're all right here.
Okay, it's okay now. So continue. I'm sorry about that.
We've got some storms blowing over here. Talking about making connections. We're all in particular places, and I'm in a place that's got thunderstorms rolling through right now. So, you know, make connections with your environment. Get out into nature. If you live in a city, you know, pay attention to the cracks, the grass growing through the cracks. Look up at the sky sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Make connections within yourself. Use any method that you can to access rather than cut off your feelings. The key with feelings, especially the feelings you don't want, is express and let go rather than repress and thereby hang on to.
Because, right. You want to acknowledge it and send it out.
Yeah, well, and you may need to stay with it for a while. Grief takes a while.
Right.
But the thing is with feelings is, and this is sort of my next gem of wisdom, is to remember that you're an animal and respect your own animal rights. As an animal, you've got feelings. That's the thing about animals. We've got feelings, and these feelings grow in your body. You don't get to say whether you're going to have them or not. You don't get to say, I'm not going to be angry about things, or I'm not going to be sad about things, any more than you get to say, oh, I'm not going to need vitamin C anymore. It's just not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have the feelings. And so your choice is not, do I have feelings or not, but what am I going to do with the feelings that I have? If you find ways to feel them, express them, ideally in words to other people, but any other way you can, art, music, dance, feel, express, that's what's going to send those feelings on their way. If you push them down, they're just going to keep on hanging around in your body, and they're going to come out one way or another. Could come out as depression, could come out as bursts of anger, could come out as phobias you don't know where they came from. It's all just feelings hanging around in your body without anywhere to go.
Now, anger, it's good to express it and let it go, but there are certainly plenty of angry activists that express themselves to those that aren't following their way.
Mm.
And they do it in a way that turns everyone off.
Mm-hmm.
So,
nonviolent communication is the key.
There we go. There's another good catchphrase.
Yeah. I mean, and the thing is, generally, if you're sort of just sort of venting rather than really expressing, it doesn't really get it out of your system either. And especially if you're venting in a way that puts other people off, then you're not going to be making those connections that are really going to be sustaining to you and make your activism sustainable. So, you know, you're going to run a real high risk of burnout. So there's lots of ways to express anger that are both healthy for you and healthy for other people and actually might lead to productive change. Certainly in interpersonal interactions, anger can be expressed within what's called nonviolent communication. That that means owning your feelings, saying things like, I feel this, rather than you make me feel that.
Right. It's amazing what a little shift in presentation or perspective can change everything.
Mm-hmm. I feel, I statements, I feel this. Not you make me feel that, or not this thing is true. I feel this. Also focusing, if you're actually expressing anger to someone who has made you angry, someone who has done something that has led you to feel angry, then it's really important to focus on the behavior rather than on the person. And not to attribute thoughts or feelings to that other person that they've not expressed. A lot of times when we get mad at people, we'll, in the course of expressing our anger or arguing back and forth, trying to solve the conflict, we'll say things that are based on what we assume they think or feel, but we really don't know what they think or feel. All we know is the behavior we've seen. And so if you can just focus on that, on the things you actually know, you're going to have a higher chance of resolving the conflict. Those are just a few keys. People can look up nonviolent communication.
Okay. I'm talking with Patrice Jones, and she has a website, patricejones.info. Lots of good things there and links to articles and information. And I want to get back now to this, to connecting the dots, racism, homophobism, sexism, speciesism, and sometimes it frustrates me because there are so many different organizations and they're focusing on a piece. It could be a charity for a disease. It could be a nonprofit for the environment. It could be a gay and lesbian rights organization. It could be a feminist group. And they're working on a small piece of the pie and they're not getting the big picture.
Uh-huh.
And it frustrates me because I think if we all work together as one big giant group with the big picture, we'd solve the problem much more quickly. But I'm not exactly sure where I'm going with this, but people seem to hang on to one particular item and aren't able to see the big picture. I talked a little bit about this a few weeks ago with Carol Adams, and she was connected with this eco-feminist community, and some women didn't want to read her writings because they knew where it was going to lead them, and they weren't ready to be vegetarian.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm always infinitely frustrated with groups like the Sierra Club and others who tend to serve meat at some of their events, and mm-hmm. they wave the flag for the environment, and they maybe not as much as before, but there's still plenty of it where the head is in the sand about what truly is causing the most damage to the environment, and it's animal agriculture. And then I remember protesting once at a, I think it was a Ringling Brother and Barnum and Bailey circus thing at Madison Square Garden, and we were protesting their treatment of the animals in the circus. And a number of people walked by, parents with children, and they were all very frustrated, you know, like, why are we protesting such a wonderful thing for children? And what surprised me, too, is that the women would stand up for the activity, and then black women would stand up for the activity, and I would think, why do these women not realize what it seemed like they were hanging on to their place in the hierarchy somehow, that I'm above them, so why don't we just leave it the way it is? Do you know at all what I'm getting at here?
Yeah, I hear you. It's I mean, there's so many things that I think in response to what you just said. It's hard for me to figure out which one. to say first? The first thing I would say, I guess, is that it has always been difficult for social change organizations of all stripes to widen their focus and understand how what they're working on relates to what other people are working on. And there are a lot of complicated reasons for that. The people who start organizations tend to be really, really closely focused on a particular issue. People's egos and identities get very caught up in a particular way of looking at things, or on this idea that this is the most important problem and we must solve this.
And this happens within vegetarian groups.
Pardon?
It happens with like-minded groups too. That came.
Oh yeah, yeah, of course. Mm-hmm. With every group. And you know, I've been saying since I don't know, the first time I heard what Hansen had to say, that really, you know, the only people who have the right to say this is the most important thing and we all should be working on this is probably the people who are working on climate change. Because truly, if we don't solve that, then, you know, all the rest starts to become irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, if we don't solve that, folks who are disadvantaged due to race or poverty, et cetera, are going to get the worst of it anyway. But, you know, leaving that one issue aside, I think, you know, it's pretty clear that it's all one big struggle. Sort of the last, and we seem to be moving in progressive circles toward an understanding of that. You know, if you look back, we see, you know, in the 70s and in the 80s, people starting to understand. Largely as a result of black feminist activists and writers and other women of color, but others as well, really start to understand how race and gender are just inexplicably interwoven, that race is gendered and that gender is raced.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the link between race and poverty is pretty clear.
Right.
And then in the late 80s was when folks started talking about environmental racism, and there at least started to be an understanding of how that linked in to the matrix. Sexual orientation came in also in the 70s as people were understanding that as a function of sexism rather than a freestanding problem of its own. And so really it's speciesism that's sort of the last piece of the puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
That hasn't quite been accepted within progressive circles, and similarly folks working within the animal movement have had that monomaniacal focus on animals, and so they've been slow.
Mm-hmm.
At times to see connections with other issues, understand the importance of attending to social justice, not only in coalition efforts, but within organizations. You know, we've still got a lot of those male-headed women work organizations.
Right.
In the animal movement. The organized animal rights movement is not all white by any means, certainly not as white as it's portrayed, but still disproportionately white, particularly if you look at poll data that shows that black and Latino women are actually more open to animal rights than white women.
They are?
And, yeah, see?
Mm-hmm.
Stereotypes going on. And so I guess what I'm saying is there's a lot of work that needs to be done from both sides. On this, and you know, some of that work is being done, has been done. Folks have started to think through really specifically how race and speciesism link up, while at the same time other folks have been, you know, working on the whole problem of just getting getting social justice activists to be, you know, at least a little bit more open-minded about the animal rights question, and getting animal rights activists to get that what they're working on links up with these other things. So that work's being done, but it's not done yet.
Right.
And
the only
if the experience
thing, the only
of other
thing.
Movements is any guide, we're in for a long and sometimes emotionally difficult haul. I mean,
right.
By no means was it easy for the feminist movement to get to the point where it is now, where, you know, you take a women's studies course, you take women's studies 101, chances are your teacher's going to tell you right off the bat racism and sexism are linked.
Mm-hmm.
That we didn't get that way without a lot of tears and anger and struggle between anti-racist activists and feminist activists.
You're right, and those issues still aren't solved either.
And it's still not all fixed by any means.
But
right.
Fortunately, we're talking about it, whereas 50 years ago we really weren't. And
right, we're still decades back.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of bringing animals into the analysis that most that progressive folks have, and that work just has to be done, but it has to be done, I think, with a great deal of empathy and modesty on both sides.
Mm-hmm. So I'm changing the subject again.
Sure.
Save a bird and bring it to your sanctuary.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm sure the stories are different, but what happens and how does the bird express itself? Does it go through a period of shock or is it tremendously joyful? How do they express themselves during that period?
There's a high level of variability. It'll so much depends on the circumstances that the bird came from, and also the personality of the individual bird.
Mm-hmm.
Birds who fall off of trucks headed to the slaughter factory are generally only 6 to 8 weeks old.
Mm-hmm.
So they're juveniles.
Mm-hmm.
They've never seen anything other than juveniles their own age. They were not raised by their parents. They were not socialized by other birds. And they were living in these crowded, darkened sheds. And they're really young. Their brains haven't even fully developed yet. So they will usually, there'll be a day or two where they're just sort of in shock, often. And then they'll usually affiliate with an older bird or two who will sort of show them the ropes.
Mm-hmm.
Hens coming from egg factories, so much depends on how long they were in the factory. Hens who are so-called spent hens, who've been in a factory for 18 months or so, they may have, their muscles may have even begun to atrophy from not being able to walk at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so walking may literally be a challenge for them at first, because they've actually not done anything but stand in these little cages clutching the wires with their feet, which are often, you know, injured and crippled from that. But even they, what will happen is they'll tend to sort of huddle together in the shed, really just for a day.
Mm-hmm.
And then the most intrepid of the group, you know, starts venturing out, and the others follow. And then, oh, look, water, food. What's this green out there?
Mm.
What's this blue up there? And they tend to be eventually, especially the so-called white leghorn hens. Once they've fully recovered, I don't think they ever fully recover.
Sure.
They're always still a bit traumatized. But once they're in good health again, they tend to be among the wildest birds we've got. They fly. They go up into the trees. Anything that you'd
Well, what do they have to lose? They've seen the worst, so they can
that
do
could
anything.
Be it. But I've certainly learned a lot from them, because when I think about the trauma that they've undergone, and then I see how after a period of really the same kind of thing that we need to recover from our trauma, a safe place, relationships with others, relationships with the natural world. They're able to recover. But what's really amazing to me is the degree to which they're able to seize joy every day, regardless of their past. And I really try, especially since so much of what I do reminds me of so many things that are so awful. You know, I really try to, at the same time, sort of follow their lead, and just as they will, just so excitedly run to see what that new mud puddle might have in it, or what might be on that new bush. You know, I try to, you know, when there's a little bit of happiness, as I had today when it turned out that the black raspberry bushes are now full of ripe fruit. You know, I try to really seize that little bit of happiness.
Right.
Because that's going to sustain me and help me be able to tolerate looking at the horrible things we've got to look at and thinking about the horrible things we've got to think about.
So, I just want to talk now about food. Are you a foodie? Do you like food? Do you enjoy any particular kind of food, or is it just something that keeps you going?
Karen, I'm so sorry, but I've lost you.
Oh, do you hear me now?
Yes, I do.
Okay, I'm sorry. That's technology for you. I want to talk about food because it's one of my favorite subjects. It's the name of the show. It's all about food, and even though everything we've been talking about is related to food, are you an eat to live or a live to eat? Do you enjoy what you eat?
I'm neither. I'm in between those two extremes. If I get so caught up in my work, I will sometimes forget to eat until I find myself standing in front of the refrigerator eating handfuls of raw lettuce or spinach. I do also. I enjoy cooking. I enjoy baking especially. I've got a serious sweet tooth, and you know you can't satisfy that if you're vegan. I mean, with rare exceptions, unless you're baking yourself.
Maybe you'll realize
where you live.
Now that
you're living. I've been living in a rural area.
That's right. But when you move to the city, especially
in
Minneapolis, there's some wonderful bakeries.
I know that's true, but I've been living in a rural area, so I've had to hone my vegan baking skills, and happily so, because I really enjoy baking.
Right. Well, I want to bring it up, and I always like bringing it up, because the bottom line is we talk about all these awful things going on, and our solution is to eat plant foods and not eat from animals, but the point I always want to make is no one's going to be missing anything because the food that we eat is full of variety, full of color, full of diversity, certainly full of nutrients and delicious, 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 and you can make almost everything.
Mm-hmm.
And the baked goods that are coming out today, prepared or the ones that you can make at home, they're all phenomenal. There's more and more great vegan cookbooks coming out. So I'm always curious to talk about food and see what other people like to eat because it's important.
Well, today I was eating these black raspberries off the bush here in Vermont, and you can actually taste the perfume of the flower slightly in the berries.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time as I was just savoring that, at the same time the thought came into my mind, what in the world have we done to the world?
Right.
Because this is so different
from what you buy in the store.
Yeah.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up because I have so many different memories, but it's so important to eat locally grown organic food as fresh as possible, and if you can, grow food. When I grew up, there were blackberry bushes all around the neighborhood before they started flattening the place to build more houses.
Right, and listen, just changing your own diet, and this actually links to what I wanted to say when you were saying about eating, because you know what, changing your own diet, that's really good, it's really important to do, that's not enough.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you want to talk about making all these connections, et cetera, well, you know, how are people in cities in some neighborhoods in the cities going to go vegan if, you know, they don't even sell fresh fruits or vegetables in the grocery stores that they can get to. And linking to what you just said, I mean, supporting things like community gardens, rooftop gardening projects, urban gardening projects, farmers markets, bringing them into inner cities, any kind of effort that we can do to bring healthier food to a wider variety of people is essential.
Right. It's all part of the picture.
Absolutely. I just wanted to say, because I know we're almost out of time when we were talking about making all these connections, it's a wonderful book that's going to be coming out from my publisher, Lantern Books. The anthology is called the Sista Vegan Anthology, and it's an anthology of writing by black vegan women in North America. And I've read it because I wrote the afterword. What infuses almost virtually every chapter written by a different person is an understanding of how this is all connected, and it's not just about changing your own personal diet. This is a health issue, this is a spiritual issue, this is a political issue, this is an issue involving racism, this is an issue involving sexism, and yes, you got to go vegan yourself, but that's not enough.
Yeah, I agree it's not enough, but we can only control ourselves. And we can do it with joy. We can be the best model that we can so that other people get curious, and we can make it infectious where other people want to learn about why we're at peace or why we're so joyful or so radiant or whatever.
I hear you, but me personally, I wouldn't, you know, I'm not at peace. You know, I mean, I'm at peace to a certain degree, but, you know, as long as we've got that grocery store problem, for example, in the city, whatever city I might be living in, then, you know, I'm not going to be able to fully be thrilled with all the wonderful vegan options that are available to me. And I do think that if we are privileged in some way, I mean, all of us humans are privileged by being within speciesism, all of us humans are privileged over animals. And yes, you're right, some people who are disadvantaged among people will cling to that privilege over animals. But one of the reasons they cling is because of the inequality among people. So fixing that will help.
Right.
And, you know, I just think that if you've got power, if you're middle class or above, if you're white, if you're male, you've got an absolute ethical obligation to actually work on one of those problems.
Well, that's why we're here today talking about what we're talking about. And Patrice,
right.
It's been great talking to you. That music means we're out of time.
Beautiful.
So
thank you for having me so much. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I love talking to you, and keep doing what you're doing.
Ditto.
Okay, thank you. So that's been Patrice Jones. Her website is patricejones.info. And this has been It's All About Food. I'm Karen Hartglass. Be back next week. Thank you.